I'm Kathleen Denon on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 23rd of October. Paul Krugman is our guest the first hour of our show today, New York Times columnist, Nobel Prize winner for economics in 2008, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, and he's got a cover story in the current issue of Rolling Stone. And it's very interesting. It's in defense of Obama. The Nobel Prize-winning economist, once one of the president's most notable critics on why Obama is a historic success. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many. Give us a chance to talk for a bit with Paul Krugman, and then we'll open up phone lines. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Paul Krugman. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi there.
So have you ever been on the cover of the Rolling Stone before?
Well, I'm not, you know. It's not my face there on the cover. It's this other guy who, for some reason, is sitting in the White House.
But it's
different, anyway.
Right. I think you should frame it. Yeah, it's not every day you get it on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Somehow I don't feel like a rock star. But anyway, yeah. It was an article I think needed to be written. Kind of interesting to be out there.
Well, and coming from you, it's getting a whole lot of attention because, as you write in the first sentence, when it comes to Barack Obama, you have always been, as you say, out of sync. What do you mean by that?
Back in 2008, when he was running, there was a lot of people were very, very enthusiastic. They thought it was great. I mean, obviously, during the Democratic Party, there was a Democratic primary, against Hillary Clinton, there were a lot of people who were very, very enthusiastic about Obama. People thought that everything would change, that the whole culture of Washington would change. I never bought into any of that. I never bought into any of the romanticism. And I was very concerned that he would, in fact, not change enough, that was really important was institutional change. Above all, my biggest priority then was health reform. I thought Hillary's plan was more serious than his, and I wasn't sure that he had the necessary understanding of just how brutal it was going to be to get it through. So here we are, 6 years later, and health reform has happened. In fact, it's actually Hillary Clinton's plan, not his, if you go back to 2008. But he, and obviously with help from a lot of other people, he got it through, despite some scary developments along the way, it has happened. He's gotten financial reform, which is important, not everything by a long shot we would have wanted, but he's gotten it through. Those are very, very big changes in the way America is. Those are lasting changes. We are not going back to a situation in which if you don't happen to get have a good job that comes with health insurance and you don't have to be over 65, well, you're out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very big deal, and it's amazing to see him get all this trash talk from right and left when, in fact, he's done more to change America in the right direction than we've seen in a long time.
Well, you talk about the number of people whose lives have been made better, and this is not a small number, 10 million people, and a number that you say is certain to grow greatly over the next 2 years as more people learn about the Affordable Care Act and the penalties kick in for failing to sign up. So you could have tens of millions of people now covered who weren't before.
That's right. It's a slightly more complicated system, a lot more complicated than I'd like, and so there will be people who fall through the cracks. But basically, if you are a legal resident of the United States, you are now entitled to some kind of affordable health care, which is the name of the act. And we're talking probably in the end 25, 30 million people who would otherwise not have had insurance. That's a huge change. If you think about what it is like, particularly if you're older, not to have health insurance, and what a big difference that makes. We haven't seen anything like that since the creation of Medicare and Medicaid back in the 60s.
When you write early on, Paul, that the president may have been naive, that he didn't really anticipate facing scorched earth Republican opposition from day one, do you think that he really believed that he would be able to institute health care reform fairly easily?
My sense, and I can't prove this, is that yes, He was expecting. We know that from reporting of various people that the stimulus plan, the original economic plan, they thought they could, by adapting it, by having more tax cuts and less spending, they thought they could get a substantial number of Republicans on board. They expected to see substantial bipartisan support for a lot of things he did. So Obama and his team thought that the kind of brutal pummeling that Bill Clinton took during his first couple of years in Washington was something that only happened to people named Clinton. They didn't think it was going to happen to them. So they really were naive.
And what about the criticism from the left that he had the House, he had the Senate, he had the presidency? Why didn't he do single-payer health care?
Well, he would have had to overturn the filibuster, right? You needed, you would have had to completely blow away the filibuster, which nobody has done, and he hasn't done. He would have had to pass stuff with a bare majority of senators, because they had only, then they only had 60 senators for a few months in 2009. It really was a remarkably short period in which you could do really big stuff without overturning the filibuster. You had not all those Democrats are all that liberal either. So he would have had to completely upend all of the rules of legislative process to go for single payer. Maybe, I don't know, maybe some other person would have done that. I don't think there was any sentiment for going that way. Realistically, the health care reform we got was about as good as we were going to get. I would have liked, maybe we could have had a public option. But and I think that may be a possibility sometime down the road. But, wow, talk about the perfect being the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. If you held out for Medicare for all, we would have had nothing.
And let's talk about costs for a moment. I think this may be an underreported story, but you talk about overall health spending slowed substantially, and also that the premiums on the insurance policies for the ACA were well below those who had been originally projected by the Congressional Budget Office.
Yeah, I think most people, even liberals, even people who read the New York Times, may not have gotten that, because it's been not hammered. It's been scattered across different stories. Sure, the costs, the premiums for the first year were about 15% below what the Congressional Budget Office had expected. Premium changes for 2015 look very small, in fact, going down in some states. So it's really coming in, the act itself is coming in much cheaper than expected. And something has happened to overall health care cost inflation. Has really drastically slowed, and Medicare has slowed, the private health costs have slowed. Some of that, we don't know what caused it, but some of it is probably because there are a bunch of cost control measures that are part of Obamacare. If we had a Republican administration which had tried to privatize Medicare and all that, and they had this kind of health numbers, they would be trumpeting it as proof of the triumph of the free market. Instead, it's something that people barely know about, but it's huge. It changes the healthcare picture. The budget picture, looking out 10, 15, 20 years, is much better than people imagined. So this is a really unsung piece of good news.
Let's talk about the federally funded expansion of Medicaid, which, as you know, has become a campaign issue. It is in the gubernatorial race here in the state of Wisconsin. You write that millions of low-income Americans will be slipping into the loophole that Justice Roberts created. Some states are blocking that expansion, you write, out of sheer spite.
Yeah, it's the most amazing thing. It's an expansion that is wholly paid for by the federal government. For the first few years, and then 90% paid for thereafter. So a state that signs on to the Medicaid expansion gets a lot of its lower-income residents get health insurance. It's actually good for business. It's good for the hospitals. It brings money into the state. It should be a no-brainer. And yet we have about half the states refusing to expand Medicaid simply because, well, it's a Democratic initiative. It's got the name Obama on it. And anyway, apparently the kind of people who would benefit from a Medicaid expansion are the sort of people where not only don't you want to help, you want to positively hurt if you can by denying them free money.
Well, those who would not be in favor of the expansion would say, you know, we don't have complete faith in the government. A lot of people don't have faith in it. Who knows 3 years from now if the money's going to be there and we don't have to be footing the, we don't want to have to be footing the bill.
Oh, that's, you know, that is completely at odds with everything we know from history. The federal government has never defaulted on its obligations to give states the money it's promised. It, you know, where is that coming from? If there was something else, if it was highway construction, if it was military contracts, there's no way that states would hesitate for a second. It's because it's aid to poor people and because it comes with the label Obamacare that they're against it. It's that's completely disingenuous, and it's transparent.
Let's move to, and after we do this, we'll go to phone calls, I promise. Our number is 800-486-8655. Financial reform, you're not entirely flattering here. You say that it should have been followed by a drastic crackdown on Wall Street abuses. Why didn't that happen, and what good did come from the financial reform?
Okay, so I think, do that backwards. Why didn't it happen? I think they were... This is not a rock the boat president. He's not. Nothing I say in Rolling Stone or that I said elsewhere suggests that I think that he's a charismatic, a fire breathing leader. And there are times when we could use that. And I think a few dramatic examples of calling wrongdoing on Wall Street to account would have been helpful for the general climate here. However. Leave that aside. So he didn't do that. He was afraid that they would, or people around him thought that it would undermine confidence or that it would simply open up political battle on that they didn't want to fight. But the actual reform does several really important things. One is that we do have a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has that as its sole mission. That's Elizabeth Warren's idea, which is turning out to be really very effective. Turns out once you create an agency that whose job is to protect consumers, not to protect the banks, it goes after a lot of stuff. It's clearly having a strong effect in reducing predatory financial practices. We have this special designation of strategic important financial institutions, which are then subjected to extra regulation. They have to put up more capital. They have to there's more scrutiny over their risk-taking. That's looking like it's a serious thing, and you can tell it's serious because whenever an institution is notified that it might be put on that list, they scream bloody murder and fight to not be put on it, which means that we are, in fact, doing significant regulation of big. You know, we're not doing way too big to fail, but we are saying that if you're too big, you're going to be subjected to a lot more scrutiny than if you aren't. And last, there's this thing which I don't think many people really understand at all called orderly liquidation authority, which basically gives the government something it did not have during the financial crisis, which is clear legal authority to step in and seize a financial institution that is threatening to bring down the economy. And what that means is you keep it running, so you avoid collapse, but you can clean. You don't have to bail out the stockholders. You don't have to bail out the executives. So there was a real debate. I mean, I was in, to some extent, inside the tent on that debate over whether to temporarily put Citigroup or Bank of America or some other large institutions into receivership because it was clear that they needed taxpayer backing, so why should the stockholders get anything out of the deal? And unfortunately, the lawyers were very skeptical. They were saying, we're not sure that we have the legal authority to do this. I think they could have done it anyway, but it was ambiguous, but now it's clear. So the next time it rolls around, we'll be able to deal with a crisis in a way that is fairer to the ordinary people, to the people of America, and less of a giveaway to the bankers.
Mm-hmm. Paul Krugman, do you think there were important figures who engaged in criminal behavior who should have gone to jail over the Wall Street abuses?
I still find myself scratching my head over the fact that Angela Mozilla, I don't know whether people should have gone to jail, but I think they should have gone to trial. There were and then we would have had that case played out in court. There was clearly a lot of deliberately fraudulent behavior. And it's true that it's proving that it's actually illegal as opposed to just plain deceptive is not so easy, but I would have liked to see that tried rather mm-hmm. than simply assumed that this is not something we're going to want to go. You can't have that big a bubble without a lot of actual fraud along the way.
I think most of us would believe that Wall Street is giving money in equal amounts to Republicans and Democrats. But you write in this article that Wall Street is overwhelmingly supporting Republicans now.
Oh, yeah. That's not a supposition. You can go to opensecrets.org, and you'll see that, in fact, in past elections, it has tended to give roughly comparable amounts to the two parties. In fact, the high-end Wall Street, investment banking and all of that, is for a big business, has historically been surprisingly, it's never been, you know, overwhelmingly Democratic the way that tobacco is overwhelmingly Republican, but it's been relatively favorable to Democrats, I think, because of cultural issues, because they tend to be social liberals and all of that. Not anymore. With financial reform, Wall Street has swung overwhelmingly to the Republicans. It started giving money as if it were tobacco or oil, and that's again telling you that if you think that President Obama didn't do anything, well, follow the money, and the money is saying that Wall Street is really quite unhappy with not being allowed to play the games the same way it used to.
We've yet to talk about the stimulus, the environment, and social issues. It's really interesting when you look at what's happened. He writes, and I think this is very true, in a short stretch of time, become a more tolerant, open-minded nation. How did that happen? Should we have had more stimulus? How is the economy doing? What about jobs for people? Are people happy with the amount of money they're taking home, et cetera? Paul Krugman is our guest this hour. He's a New York Times columnist, a Nobel Prize winner for economics in 2008, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, and he wrote the cover story for this week's Rolling Stone magazine, which has a picture of the president, and the article is in defense of Obama by Paul Krugman. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in just one moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Paul Krugman, starting with Mike in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Kathleen and Professor Krugman. I'm a liberal Democrat, voted for Obama twice, read the New York Times, and I'm a retired physician. But on these issues, I have to agree with Professor Krugman. One, health care. We have insurance available, but the copays are so high that the people in my blue-collar community cannot afford the copays. That was front-page New York Times Sunday issue. I've just visited my insurance agent. His annual health care premiums for he and his wife are $18,000 a year. Just met a woman, a clerk at my hardware store, who received a $63,000 bill for a gallbladder operation. Two, the economy. He could have tried to reinstitute Glass-Steagall. He didn't do it. We still have casinos at our banks. And three, his handling of the Ebola crisis is abysmal. Any second-year medical school student learns an infectious disease, quarantine, 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 and I can't believe what he is doing. I watched the Roosevelt documentary. We need a forceful leader like Teddy or Franklin Roosevelt, and Obama is neither. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for the call. Paul.
Yeah, on Ebola, I've been not saying a whole lot, but the idea that something is being done terribly wrong, that's just hype. I mean, it's not in fact out of control here. It's I think people are saying that he should have panicked, and that I don't think makes sense. On the health plans, which is an important issue, what is true is that if you bought the lowest allowed class of plan, which is the bronze plans, they do have pretty high copays, and that's you can argue that people should not have been allowed to take plans that had those limited features. Although, if you remember, there was this huge fuss over some plans were canceled, and those were plans that were even worse. They were even worse than what's allowed. The fact of the matter is, the great majority of people who are getting coverage under either the Medicaid expansion or through the exchanges are, in fact, finding that it makes a big positive difference in their lives. It's not perfect. There are holes. There are things going wrong. But the idea that this is a failure, it's just completely out of proportion with what's really going on. On you know, Glass-Steagall, I have to say that, that people talk about that, but that's actually, that misunderstands what the problem was. I mean, I think Glass-Steagall should not have been repealed, but Glass-Steagall was a regulation on ordinary, conventional deposit-taking banks, you know, big marble buildings with rows of tellers. The whole problem in our financial crisis has not been there. It has been with banking institutions that are not exactly banks. And what Glass-Steagall did is said that the, you know, this Citibank could not also be involved in this other stuff. The regular banks could not be involved in it. But that really wasn't, it's not all clear that that's what's important. Remember Lehman Brothers, which was the trigger point that brought down the world, would not have been covered at all under Glass-Steagall. It wasn't a deposit-taking bank. So people who think that we had a system that would have covered all of this, and if only we'd gone back to the way the world was in 1999, it would have been fine, they're not understanding the crisis. The crisis was about shadow banking. It was about all this other stuff. And what the financial reform did was to partially extend regulation to this broader, you know, shadow banking sector. I would have liked more. I would have liked higher capital requirements. I would have liked more regulation of derivatives. It's not the financial reform. I think I give health reform an A-, and I probably give financial reform a B, but a lot better than nothing.
Mm-hmm. What about the more commonly called Obamacare? Do you have a sense, Professor Krugman, of how it's playing out in elections around the country? Is it being used by Republicans a lot? Is it being used less than you would think?
Oh, it's amazing, actually. It's largely faded as a campaign issue.
Really?
Now, you could say that, yeah, if you actually look, and if you watch, I mean, it was, that was all, that was some kind of a master performance in surrealism. If you listen to Mitch McConnell trying to say that, well, he's against Obamacare, but he's for everything that it does, and trying to confuse voters into thinking that, that they can have Kinect, the Kentucky version of it, without having Obamacare. And he may be good enough at obfuscating to get away with that, but the fact of the matter is Republicans have largely, not completely, but largely stopped campaigning against it because the horror stories are not actually coming true, and a significant number of people are benefiting, and you can't really run against that. So you know, you'd think, why isn't it a big plus? Why aren't Democrats able to capitalize on it? And part of the answer is it's new. Not enough people have seen the benefits yet, and partly it's the answer is that a lot of the state-level Democrats are still very, very timid. I think McConnell would be in more trouble if his opponent had been more willing to just forthrightly say, this is a good thing, and Mitch McConnell wants to take it away from you again.
Well, that brings me to another question before we get back to the phone calls. Forgive me, audience, we'll be right there. But the Democrats have been walking away from this president because they're worried about he's not very popular and the poll numbers aren't good. And you address that issue in the article. I guess, you know, boiling it down to poll numbers don't mean what they used to mean.
Yes, part of the point is that we are a polarized nation. And it used to be the case that there were some Republicans who would nonetheless say, well, I approve of a president even though he's a Democrat. Very few people like that anymore. So there's no way that that Obama, if Obama were bringing us into a magical golden age of prosperity and peace, he would probably have 53% approval. I mean, this is that we're that kind of country now. And if you look at the electoral picture, I mean, we don't know. The midterms are still to come, but it's probably the case that Republicans will take the Senate, but it's not overwhelming even now. The governor's races are actually looking relatively good for Democrats a little bit. This is not what you would see if we had a nation that was aghast at its president and eager to vote for anybody who stood against him. We're seeing a nation that's feeling pretty lousy about a lot of stuff, and includes they feel lousy about the president, they feel lousy about Congress, they feel lousy about, I think, just about everything except drama on cable TV. And so these are unhappy times, but not the kind of political disaster for Obama and his achievements that people would have you believe.
Scott in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Before I ask my question, I would like to congratulate you on being nominated to the Milwaukee Media Hall of Fame.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Big event tomorrow.
I'm sorry?
The big event is tomorrow.
Oh, good.
And my coworkers gave me the most delicious chocolate cake about an hour before I went on the air that you could imagine. Ooh, it was good.
Well, I'm jealous. my question, actually, I guess you sort of have implied the answer, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway. Let's say that 2 years from now, in 2016, the Republicans are able to get control of both houses and the presidency. Do they go ahead and try to overturn Obamacare anyway? Which has been, I'm highly suspicious that anybody on the Republican side could get the nomination without at least saying, I'll overturn Obamacare.
Yeah, pretty clearly, whoever gets the nomination will at least have had to mumble something to that effect, and it's possible that they would go and overturn it. But at that point, the odds are that that would mean taking away health insurance from 25 million people. Maybe they can do that, but that would be, I think that would come as a huge shock to a lot of people. I think there would be a political firestorm, and I think they know that too. And so you can never tell. I mean, I would not have thought, if you'd asked me even 4 years ago, if I thought there was a real possibility that that Republicans would threaten, even for a minute, to force the United States into default by refusing to raise the debt ceiling, and they did. We came very close to all hell breaking loose. So these old rules may not apply, but Republicans themselves have often in candid moments said that we must never allow health reform to happen because once it happens, it can't be done away with because too many people will benefit. And now it has happened. So I would be surprised if they are willing to uproot something that will already, by the time President Ted Cruz takes office, God knows what happens then. But if we get to that point, this will already have become an important part of American life, and people would be utterly shocked if you tried to take it away.
Thank you, Scott, so much for the call. Rich emails this question from Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Does Professor Krugman believe that race is a big factor in Obama's presidency? I think that there are, he writes, unfortunately, a great number of Americans who have a difficult time identifying with their president as a black man.
I go back and forth, honestly. Clearly, race is always a factor in American politics. On the other hand, I do remember, I remember 20 years ago. I'm old enough to remember the Clinton years, and that was insane. The stuff that was being said about Bill Clinton, he was a drug smuggler, Hillary murdered Vince Foster,
right.
It was a completely mad thing. There were sitting members of the Senate who more or less said, Clinton might face violence against his person if he visits my state. So I'm not sure how much of it is that he's a black man and how much of it is simply that he's a Democrat in the White House. That seems to bring out the crazies regardless.
Well, let's talk about a part of the article that appears at the end, and I thought about it, and I've thought about this a lot, Professor Krugman, that you write that we have, in a remarkably short stretch of time, become a notably more tolerant, open-minded nation. And that would be so true on certain issues like same-sex marriage, women's issues. I'm not sure about racial issues, but when you look at, did the president have anything to do with our becoming more tolerant?
Oh, and by the way, on racial issues, slightly longer time frame, but not as long as people think. Back in the 80s, if you asked people, do you think that interracial marriage is okay? A plurality of Americans said no.
They did?
Yeah.
Oh, that's, my gosh.
We're talking about during the Reagan years. So we have come, despite everything that's still wrong, we've come a very long way, even on racial issues. It's just not the same place as it was when I was, when I was already... not a young man. So, sorry, I lost a thread here. But something has happened. It's a remarkable change. I don't know how much Obama is responsible. Probably mostly not. Certainly not on things like gay marriage or marijuana legalization. But he may be more of a symptom than a than a cause, in the sense that despite all of the stuff we've been talking about, not that long ago a black president would have been inconceivable.
That's true. That is true. Rob in Mexico. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually formerly from Wisconsin, from Madison, so I've followed Wisconsin Public Radio on the Internet all along. But my question or comment would be, I'm always amazed at how little is made of the economic shift that must be taking place with the costs that are borne by hospitals and the, just the healthcare, institutions in general, between having people getting their health care ad hoc at random and not being denied for care, albeit that they don't have any insurance or didn't have any insurance, versus today when this thing is being organized in an orderly fashion and costs are being negotiated and anticipated in advance. And to this day, it's amazing to me the comments a minute ago about how much is this being used in elections right now. I don't maybe so much hear politicians talking about it, except that the polarized electorate, the comments that come from people saying, well, Obama made us get this compulsory health insurance, and I'm really upset with him about that, and that's a violation of my personal rights or something. Well, I never heard anybody saying they'd be willing to sign a letter that said if they ever need care that the institution's free to deny them care, because they don't have the money to pay for it, which simply means the rest of us were left bearing the cost for that. But anyway, is it that it's too hard yet to discern how big a savings is occurring from this, or what's the story with that?
Yeah, I don't think we can put a number on it yet. How hospitals are reporting a sharp drop in the number of uninsured people showing up in emergency rooms. So they can really see it. I mean, it's one of the many pieces of evidence of just how many people have, in fact, gotten insurance. By the way, the states that have refused to expand Medicaid, of course, they're missing a large part of that advantage. And interestingly, there was federal funding that was partial compensation for hospitals having to treat the uninsured. That went away with the Affordable Care Act because everybody's supposed to be insured, which means that if you're in a non-Medicaid expansion state, your hospitals are actually now facing a significant financial burden because you're getting the, that extra fund has been taken away and you're not getting the benefit of the extra coverage. It's significant. I mean, there were some people who were hoping that not having uninsured people show up at hospitals would save so much money that covering the uninsured would pay for itself, and that was too much to expect. The people who seriously analyzed it said that it's not that big a saving, but it's significant. And of course, it's something I think you hinted at in your comment. One of the ways that healthcare was so expensive was that people who did show up without insurance and just had to pay cash on the barrel were paying very high prices. And now it's negotiated prices with insurance companies, which is part of the reason that healthcare costs are looking much more under control than they were just a couple of years ago.
Thank you very much, Rob, for the call. We have yet to talk about stimulus money, and I believe Kathleen in Madison will bring us into that area. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was a recipient of some stimulus money. I worked for a long time in research at UW-Madison in clinical research, and that money kept our studies going as NIH was shrinking their budget. But I also have to talk about something that was close in my family is a biotech success story that's happening right now with Ebola testing. And I'm not sure, Kathleen, if you might have seen the news report that was on Friday in some of the Milwaukee stations that talked about Lucigen Corporation in Middleton. My husband actually was an inventor of Ebola test that is currently being tested in Africa, in the field right now.
Oh.
And that money, or the money that he found to start working on this test was provided by federal funds, an SBIR grant. So right now, it started with two people, and now they have 55 jobs for people in that area. So, without those initiatives by President Obama, that money wouldn't have been found, that discovery wouldn't have happened, and look at what it's doing right when it's needed. Right. And the CDC has tested that test, and it's happening right now. So those initiatives that President Obama really put forth as far as science and biotechnology is really, you know, occurring, and it's a real success story.
Send us more information on that, Kathleen. We may do a show on it down the road. There are stories like that when you just don't hear very much about how stimulus money went for science.
Yeah. The main purpose of the stimulus was to boost the economy, was to take the worst options off the table in terms of the Great Recession and the downturn. If it was investing in longer term things, that was an additional benefit, but not the principal purpose. And there's overwhelming agreement among economists that in fact it did help, that unemployment would have been significantly higher, things would have been worse. And then there are these investment stories that they're more subtle, I think, partly just because it's a more complicated world. They don't look like the things that happened under the WPA in the 30s. You don't see as many new buildings, dams, whatever, but there's actually a lot of stuff that came out of it. I would say renewable energy. I think I talked about that some
yes.
in the article. There was a lot of money going into renewable energy. The right has tried to say, you look at one bad loan, Solyndra, and that's the whole story. But in fact, there were a whole lot of good things. And we are having something of a green revolution in terms of energy, for which the stimulus wasn't the sole cause, but was a contributing factor. Lots of stuff that will continue to be a benefit years into the future. I didn't know about the biological stuff, but that makes sense as well.
Mm-hmm. So we had somewhat of a stimulus, but you have said, and I'm wondering how much larger you think, if a little went a long way, shouldn't it have been a much larger stimulus?
Yeah. I was calling at the time for something twice as big and longer.
Mm-hmm.
And everything I've seen since says that was right. Now, there's a different question, which is how much bigger could Obama have gotten it? And I would have liked to see them try to hold out or try to make a push for more, partly because I thought that the political dynamic would have been better. If there had been a big enough stimulus that people could really see the effects, then the political consensus for rescuing the economy would have been better. The 2010 elections wouldn't have led to as many hard right people being elected. But if people who remember reading me 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago, know that I was tearing my hair out over what I saw as a clearly inadequate plan, and I wasn't wrong about that. But you know that's water under the bridge, and we are where we are now. And I'm looking at, so what did we achieve? And that's still a lot.
Paul Krugman is our guest this hour, New York Times columnist. He has a feature story, cover story, on the current issue of The Rolling Stone. It's a picture of President Barack Obama, and his story is in defense of Obama. The article has been getting a lot of attention, partially because he is Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner for economics, and also partly because he has been critical of President Obama over the years. So this is looking at his good points. And not only that, he really believes that he has emerged as, and let me quote him, one of the most consequential and successful presidents in American history. Would you agree? Why? Why not? 800-486-8655, our number, more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Paul Krugman is our guest this hour, and let's go back to phone calls. Bill in Eau Claire, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Bill. Go
Professor
ahead.
Professor Krugman. Yeah, this is Bill. I'm in a car between Eau Claire and Milwaukee. I wanted to ask you about how you would rate the Obama administration in its policing and reform of the credit rating agencies, because credit rating agencies are a total scam because they're an inherent conflict of interest, and they really don't, and they're a cause of the big meltdown. How good was Obama's work on this issue?
No, they punted on the credit rating agencies, no question, as did everyone else, by the way. I mean, there were several different players who could have done something. We could have had a crackdown by the Europeans, we could have had a crackdown by the Bank of England, the international agencies, the Bank for International Settlements, the, IMF could have called for doing something, and nobody was willing to bite the bullet. Admittedly, I think it's politically hard because you ask, credit rating agencies are a big problem, but how do you replace them? So for people who don't know, right, we have Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and then some smaller players, and who rate, they say this is a good bond, this is a safe investment, this is not. But who pays them to make those assessments? And the answer is actually the people who they are assessing. So they used to be they would publish books, and the royalties on the books would basically pay for the credit assessments, but that's not going to work in the modern world. So instead they shifted to a system where they are paid by the people who they evaluate, obviously rife with conflicts of interest. But what's your answer? We could have public agencies doing it. How is that likely to play in the U.S. Congress? We could have specially licensed private independent agency paid for by taxpayer money. Again, how's that going to play in Congress? I think the problem was the financial reformers, they understood the problem, but they just took a look and could not figure out how to get past the political barriers.
Let's talk a little bit, and I know you've written about this, and we've done tons of shows on this wealth inequality in this country and how it just doesn't budge, and most American workers are more productive. They're not making more money. In fact, they're making a whole lot less money when you look at other decades. Was it within the purview of the president to do something about this, and why does it persist, Professor Krugman?
Well, it's within the purview of the president, but only to the extent that he can pass legislation. And more has happened there. If you look at this substantive policy, there's actually a lot more going on than people realize. The Bush tax cuts were retained for lower incomes, but at the top end, they have, in fact, gone away. And if you add in, if you look at how Obamacare is paid for, look at some of the other things that he's done, at the high end, tax rates have gone up. As best we can make out, the average tax rate on the 1%, the average federal tax rate, is about back to what it was in 1979. So, in fact, at the very top end, not only has Bush been undone, but so surprisingly has Reagan. And on the other hand, if you look at Obama's signature achievement, which is health care, the subsidies, the expansion of Medicaid are helping people lower down the income scale. Medicaid, the poor are near poor, but the subsidies, generally working class Americans. So he has engaged, in fact, in a significant policy of taxing the rich and helping ordinary Americans. Now, relative to the explosion of inequality, it's not nearly enough. If you look at what has happened, we still have a vastly richer 1% and even more so 0.1% than we did. Something is going on. I work on this. I'm very much in touch with the research. I think we still don't fully understand what's going on. We have reason to believe that there's a combination of power, corporate power being used to reward top executives, runaway finance, which is leading to a lot of money at the top, and then a kind of, Thomas Piketty's book has made a big splash by talking about the extent to which wealth feeds on wealth, and that is also an important factor. So, I would have loved to see a real New Deal type policy of not just chipping away at that, but really rolling back the inequality, but that didn't happen.
Cindy writes on Facebook, I believe part of the reason our country is able to solidly grow and change in the areas of healthcare, job creation, and regulating Wall Street quietly is that President Obama is not a rash, show-off, bully, snap decision maker. He is steady as she goes, and Cindy says, I love it.
Well, I think we could use a little more fiery rhetoric, a little more toughness. There were times in his administration when he seemed really to be willing to practically give away the store to reach some sort of bipartisan deal. Unfortunately,
right,
the Republicans were so intransigent that he didn't do it, which was a good thing. And he's all right. I'm a professor. I hang out with professors. Sometimes we say, that Obama, he's more professorial than we are.
He is professorial.
I actually would prefer that he were a little more like FDR. But It's okay. In the end, the style is not what matters. In the end, what matters is that you get stuff done, and in the end, he has.
Let's go next to Mark in West Salem. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Yeah, I have a question for Dr. Kreckman. I was wondering if he really thinks, is there any effect that he can think of as far as what the 2005 bankruptcy bill, which basically took away people's ability to shelter their homes from, say, credit card debt, and what kind of effect that had on the basically the bubble, the housing bubble, and the loans, and various people forced to use their home credit as an ATM machine to help pay off other kinds of debt, and what kind of effect he could think of it, that, how that led to the financial crisis.
Okay, well, I can step right in there. I don't think you can say that it played a big role in leading to the crisis, because the housing bubble actually reached its peak inflation in early 2006, and it's been all downhill from there. So the bankruptcy law didn't inflate the bubble. The bankruptcy law didn't cause the other stuff. The bankruptcy law has made the period since much harsher. It's caused a lot more suffering. We should have had a lot more debt relief along the way. And this is one of the areas where I do fault Obama on some policies. He could have done more, particularly on housing debt relief. But also, if we hadn't had that spectacularly bad, ill-timed law, we would have had a fair bit of debt relief just through the normal proceedings of bankruptcy. And because of that law, we've had less. So it has played a role in perpetuating the slump. It's played a role in making things crueler, harsher. I don't think anyone would put it center stage, but it was definitely a really, really bad policy. And it's a shame that we can't undo that vote. I think if that vote had been held 3 years later, it wouldn't have happened.
Thanks, Mark. You mentioned the environment. Let's talk about that a little bit more as time grows short here. There has been, you say, much more progress on the use of renewable energy than most people realize. What's the progress, Professor Krugman?
We've had a tremendous increase in the share, and a very low base, but still, we've had very rapid growth in solar, quite rapid growth in wind. We've had a dramatic change in the costs. One of those things that people still think that solar and wind are kind of hippy-dippy things from the 70s, and they go along with trying to grow your own food. And in fact, they're very close to being cost competitive with fossil fuels now, even without subsidies. And that's a dramatic change. That means that we're actually in striking distance of being able to make huge progress on the environment if only we can get Congress to act on it. So that's a big deal. On top of that, Obama, one of the policies nobody knows about are the fuel efficiency standards for vehicles, including now for trucks, which just by itself, aside from all the other things it does, it's actually a major greenhouse gas policy. And finally, the power plant rules, we'll have to see how all that works out, but he is using executive authority to impose pretty serious restraints on power plants. You know, all of this is not enough to stop us from having catastrophic global warming in itself, but it's more progress against it than we've made basically ever. So, mm-hmm. Again, one of those policies, that's kind of the theme of Obama, right? It's always not what you wish that you could have, but a lot better than people realize.
And when you say in 20 seconds that he has emerged as one of the most consequential presidents, what does that mean?
It means that he changes America, that America will be different. It will have institutions it didn't have when he's gone. So someone like Bill Clinton left the country pretty much the same as he was popular, but he left the country pretty much the same as it was when he arrived. Obama won't do that. Obama will leave us a country that has more or less universal health care, that has new kinds of financial regulations, that has serious environmental policies it didn't have before. That's consequential.
Thank you ever so much for being with us. Enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Thank you.
Professor Paul Krugman, columnist, of course, for the New York Times. He's a Nobel Prize winner for economics, is a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. And you may want to look at his cover story. It's very interesting in the current issue of Rolling Stone as the president gets criticism from the left, the right, and the center. This article is in defense of Obama. it's worth a read. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We're going to talk about the incredible amount of money being spent on the midterms. I mean, incredible. That's coming up after the news.